Welcome to Art If, the podcast about art, life, and everything in between.
Hi, and welcome back to episode 17 of the Art If podcast. I'm Yossi.
And I'm Hattie. In this week's gallery, we bring in a guest to do our homework for us.
We're busy and tired, and he knows more, so why not?
Totally. Our theme this week is art and the city. So we're talking with our guest about the ways that art institutions create civic identity with theater historian Dan Bullis. And then we kick off our local artist series, which is focusing on artists from mine and Yassi's local communities.
That's right.
Our first representative is Tom Draculich, a painter and ceramics artist out of Yassi's new hometown, Reno.
That's right. And he was the quote unquote official 2019 city artist.
Fancy.
I know. First ever, actually, when we'll talk about that.
But so cool.
As always, we end with a provocation. This week's provocation asks you to confront a piece of abstract art and gives you concrete steps on how to help you develop a relationship with it.
If you love this podcast, be sure to subscribe to get the latest episodes and minisodes. So just hit that subscribe button. I can't even say subscribe, so you just have to do it.
Just subscribe.
You know the button I'm talking about.
It's on all the platforms, including Stitcher, which we're newly on. So find us on Stitcher.
All right. So art and the city is our theme this week.
That is right.
And we have something special. We actually have invited a friend of ours on to help us to do our homework for us.
Yay. Well, I mean, yeah, we cheated.
We did.
Don't tell our students.
No, we're being resourceful.
It's true. We're citing our sources.
Yeah, in the flesh.
Yeah, we're inviting them. I don't know what that means, but okay. All right, so Dan, you want to introduce yourself?
Yes. So my name is Dan Bullis. I hold a PhD in theater history from UC Santa Barbara, which is where I know these two fine ladies from.
Yes. Who you call them, and, lady?
I'm not you. I was being politic. I have long been fascinated by urban history, and my dissertation research actually looked at two cities, New York and Los Angeles, in the early to mid-1960s, and specifically looked at two theater companies within those two cities. And so, yeah.
Cool.
Awesome. So you are the perfect person to sort of talk to about how art and art makes the city.
Yeah. So I thought about bringing you on here because we're getting ready to do a production of The Tempest in the spring, and I'm doing costume design, and the director asked me to style some of the characters in Carnaby fashion. And I was like, what the hell is Carnaby fashion? Do you guys know about Carnaby?
What is Carnaby?
Carnaby.
No.
C-A-R-N-A.
Like in London?
Yes.
Is it a high...
It's...
Taylor Street?
Yes. So okay. Carnaby Street has like the first men's boutique. And then in like the 50s, it became this incredible epicenter for shopping. And there was this one boutique called Lady Jane where the girls would change in the windows. And one of the shop owners was ultimately arrested for blocking traffic because so many people were gathered staring in the windows. And then it just became this really high fashion center where rock stars would come and a lot of punk and mod and goth designers like Vivienne Westwood set up their design studios there.
Yeah, a lot
there.
Of like the new designers who have who make it like start at Carnaby Street.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, they get like their street cred.
Yeah. Well, and one of the interesting characteristics about this street is that in the 1970s, it was pedestrianized. And so that's the thing I think that made me think about how cities have these areas that become factors of identity for the city, and this big overreaching, like institutional level intentionality about the way mm-hmm. they're framed. And so that's why I thought of Dan.
Yeah. Yeah, that's like exactly what I've, you know, what I was thinking about for all those years that I was researching and writing the dissertation, because essentially the questions that I was looking at had to do with, so I was looking, to give you a little context here, I was looking specifically at two theater companies, Center Theater Group and the Mark Taper Forum, which when it was born in the, you know, mid-60s, quickly became one of the prominent regional theaters in the United States and remains so to this day. And I was looking that at that alongside with the Repertory Theater of Lincoln Center, which was a theater company that opened at Lincoln Center, obviously, in 1964, but that failed pretty quickly.
Oh.
And yeah, and so what I was really looking at. No, I know. No, I never read it.
I downloaded it and I started reading the introduction.
Oh, okay.
I definitely That's read the kidding. Abstract.
You're a better friend okay. than I am.
but really, the question, like the, I was looking specifically at two things because both of those theater companies were actually part of larger institutions. The Mark Taper being part of the Los Angeles Music Center, which is the big complex on Grand Avenue in Los Angeles, and the Repertory Theater of Lincoln Center being part of Lincoln Center, which is that big, you know, monolithic campus in Midtown Manhattan. And what was interesting about looking at these two theaters side by side was that both of the parent institutions, the development of those institutions was very closely entwined with the city's sense of identity and the symbolic importance of these centers.
Yeah, like how so? Like how is...
Yeah, so Lincoln Center, so I guess I should actually kind of reframe that. They were actually, on the one hand, very important symbolic institutions in terms of advancing the city's sense of identity, but they were also pragmatic developments in terms of certain powerful elites trying to replace one vision of urbanity with another, right? So Lincoln Center was one of the last redevelopment projects of Robert Moses. And if you don't know who Robert Moses is, you should look him up because he is the single most important figure in the history of New York City.
Wow.
He
had a lot to do with swimming pools. And that's where I know about Robert Moses.
Yeah, so,
all of those pools.
Yeah. So he was responsible for things like the Long Island Expressway, the Verrazano Bridge, the United Nations.
What would you say is his, like, is he an urban planner? Is he an engineer?
Yeah. No, he's, I would say he's like, he's an urban planner. He was a bureaucrat, okay. But urban planning was kind of his thing. And he led, at one point he held, can't remember the exact number, but multiple positions in New York City government at the same time and exercised like incredible autonomous control over the built environment in New York. And he had this vision of the city that was really all about adapting New York City for the automobile. And he was one of the final projects he tried to get through and ultimately failed was an expressway that would have run through Washington Square Park and essentially eviscerated the West Village.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. But Lincoln Center was actually the urban renewal project that actually turned the public opinion tide against Robert Moses's approach to urban renewal. Because, you know, Lincoln Center sits on top of what once was a very diverse working class, low-income neighborhood. And that neighborhood was one of many throughout New York City that was bulldozed to make way for public housing projects, for institutions like Lincoln Center, and all kind of under this vision of replacing the intricate fabric of neighborhoods and small streets with these monolithic super block structures. Mm. So Robert Moses's vision of progress was all about bringing what he considered to be order to the city grid.
So I'm not a New Yorker, so I don't know anything about where anything is or what bridges I'm supposed to take and what tunnels I'm supposed to drive on.
But you're not supposed to do any bridge or tunnel work if you're really from New York.
So what's when you said something about replacing one kind of urbanism with another, and we're thinking about art centers and theater centers, I'm thinking obviously about Broadway. So what's the geographic relationship between Lincoln Center and like Broadway? And what is different about what Lincoln Center was trying to offer compared to what Broadway had to offer?
Well, and that was my question too, is like, is that why it failed? Just because there was so much competition?
In a sense, yes. So to answer the first question geographically, Lincoln Center sits about 15 blocks north of like the top end of the theater district. Mm-hmm. So Lincoln Center is at like 66th and 65th Street. And you know, the theater district runs from like 40th Street to like 52nd Street ish. And so I think one of the two big, so Lincoln Center in recent years has actually done a better job of trying to actually like interact with the street and its environs. But like when it was built, it was really this, it was set apart from the street on this, you know, big slab of concrete.
Yeah, it's like essentially back. Like a small. It's like to get there, you have to walk on a large, like, courtyard. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And that was very common in the urban renewal era. It was really all about kind of moving away from the street and kind of moving away from the vitality of sidewalk interactions. And Los Angeles Music Center not only is like removed from the street in terms of being set back, but it's also like elevated from the street and sits on top.
Yeah, it's like the Pantheon.
Parthenon.
They actually called it their modern Pantheon.
Like when
they
Parthenon.
Parthenon. Sorry, I said the one in Rome, I was like, shit, I need the one in Greece.
Yeah, just so your listeners know, I just taught two back-to-back 75-minute classes.
And it's
So when the center opened, they actually called it their modern-day Parthenon. That actually sat atop, like looked over the modern-day Acropolis, which is now the downtown business district of Los Angeles. But anyway, to go back to the question about the relationship between Broadway and Lincoln Center. So one of the reasons that the Repertory Theater of Lincoln Center failed was because it was, and the question that I'm really exploring in the dissertation is how these institutions establish their legitimacy as like civic institutions. Mm. So like Lincoln Center.
Well, how do you define a civic institution?
Like something that is expressive of civic identity, and civic identity being like the identity of a city, right? And Lincoln Center didn't have any official designation as any kind of national anything, but it was pitched from its conception as a national institution to like enshrine America's commitment to the arts. The way that the project was pitched to the public really relied very heavily on Cold War rhetoric, because the argument was, you know, the argument to justify the need to, you know, bulldoze this neighbor. So as far as Robert Moses was concerned, it was a slum clearance project. His concern was clearing what he viewed as a slum. And it was up to the people it was up to the leaders of the institutions that would rise on those grounds to make the case for their civic importance. And the case for the civic importance of Lincoln Center was that it would help demonstrate, the phrase that they used over and over again was the cultural maturity of the United States. It was meant to put the United States on equal footing with countries like the Soviet Union that had, you know, like longstanding cultural institutions.
Moscow Art Theater, London.
And the United States didn't have that. And there was no national theater in the United States. There is no national. I mean, I think the regional theaters taken together kind of constitute America's national theater. But for a long time, there was this obsession as the regional theater movement was beginning to create some kind of equivalent to the Moscow Art Theater or the Old Vic in London. Mm-hmm. Like this idea of an institution that could contain American theatrical identity, like what it is to be American theater.
Well, what is the Kennedy Center? Sorry. So what, like, what's, are they related at all?
I mean, I've not dove in too deeply into the Kennedy Center, but in terms of functionality, like the Kennedy Center operates now, my understanding, mostly as a roadhouse as opposed to like a producing organization. Yeah. And so the Repertory Theater at Lincoln Center was going to be the first, like, even though there was, it was kind of thought of as the presumptive national theater because it was in the context of Lincoln Center, which was being pitched as the national symbol of the United States' cultural maturity. Because,
and it failed.
Mind, like, and it failed.
That's telling.
Yeah. And it failed. I mean, it failed for a lot of reasons, but I think a big part of it was just the symbolic weight of it. Right now, I only looked at the first 2 years. It lasted for about 8 years, but I only looked at the first 2 years when it was led by Ilya Kazan, who was one of the most important directors of the 20th century.
After they took him off the blacklist for being a communist, they were like, "Okay, you're not a communist anymore."
Well, and interestingly enough, like I think that's also like super interesting when you think about the whole premise of Lincoln Center being pitched as essentially a Cold War project.
Yeah.
Like it really was this idea of like weaponizing culture in the ideological Cold War. Like there was one quote I was actually going through my dissertation today just to like get ready for this, and I came across this quote. I don't remember if I flagged it or not, but they actually framed the fact that they were relying on public donations, like in the sense that so they actually used like language about money to kind of phrase its civic importance. So let me just So one of the board members said that as a symbol before the world, Lincoln Center will be all the better because it will be built and supported by the freely given gifts of private individuals, foundations, and corporations. So while it didn't have national status because it was a nationally funded project, they were using the fact that they were relying mostly on public funding to kind of tout the virtues of capitalism in the context of the Cold War, even while pitching the center as something to push back against the notion that Americans only cared about the bottom line. Like that was one in terms of like Cold War logic, like that was one of the biggest struggles or one of the biggest objectives was to change the narrative in the world that America, because there was, and I guess still is, and rightfully so, both was and is, that America is a culture that's driven before all else by material comfort and material wealth and the bottom line.
And we've got another Marxist on the show.
But Lincoln Center was all about pushing back against that perception. And it was, and also interestingly, and obviously there's no time to go into this now, but one of the main lines of rhetoric that actually got the National Endowment for the Arts through Congress was Cold War rhetoric. It was emphasizing the importance of the NEA in establishing America's cultural gravitas. And in Los Angeles, what was super interesting was that the Music Center figured very prominently into a struggle over the built environment, because in the 1940s, public housing was on its way to like becoming a deeply entrenched social welfare system in Los Angeles. Like to the degree that the landscape was slowly coming to be to be dominated by public housing projects until finally the corporate elite interests in Los Angeles were able to mount this insane vitriolic red baiting campaign that killed public support. So public housing was actually widely supported in Los Angeles from the Depression through the mid 40s. But eventually with the onset of the Cold War, that gave the business elite like the rhetoric they needed to turn public opinion against public housing, which then allowed them to kind of start building the Los Angeles that we know today, like the downtown Los Angeles dominated by corporate skyscrapers and such.
Right, so, and I think Dodger Stadium was sort of like similarly built that way.
And Dodger Stadium sits on what was once known as Chavez Ravine, which was a very poor neighborhood. And the neighborhood had actually been bulldozed to make way for public housing. But then, as part of that public, the red baiting campaign, the public housing was, like, they put the kibosh on public housing. And so instead of giving that land back to the homeowners, they made the case that a good public use of the land would be Dodger Stadium. And they gave Dodger Stadium like an insane sweetheart deal. And it was all part of this rhetoric of like raising the metropolitan image of Los Angeles. Like that was the public good. It was and that was the same kind of rhetoric that the Music Center fit
into. Also seems like what's happening in both of these projects is taking artistic endeavors and making them exclusive. Trying to make it high culture and eliminating anything that's contributing any sort of alternative or countercultural perspective on what constitutes art and the arts.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think one of the reasons I love studying cities is because at the end of the day, I think what interests me in terms of how the world works is power and how power plays out. And cities are expressions. Cities are basically the results of power struggles. Mm. You know, like every, you know, because cities are such, you know, condensed geographic areas, every inch on the city grid.
Even just walking down the fucking sidewalk, you feel like you're fighting with people.
No shit.
Well, I was thinking, like, you talked a little bit about how these institutions shaped the actual physical shape of the city. And you just touched briefly upon it at the end. Like, how did they shape the image of the city? How did having these art institutions change conceptions of LA and New York or not?
Yes. So I think the impact on the perception of New York is much less than it was in LA. LA, like the driving force behind gaining public support for the Music Center and Center Theater Group specifically, was really trying to push back against the perception. As one person said, they said that the Music Center would help offset the notion that LA is a place populated by kooks.
Does that mean weird, or is there like an older definition of that word?
No, it's like weird, like you know, kooky. Because Los Angeles.
Like the Addams Family.
Los Angeles, like one other way it was described, I can't remember who said it, was Los Angeles was often described back in those days as an uncouth poor relation of San Francisco. Because one of the things that they were really trying to do in this era, especially like the business elite in terms of like trying to raise the image of this, like raise the national profile of the city, was they were trying to push back against because Los Angeles had like a steadily increasing population in the mid 20th century, but that was also at odds with this like widely held like non-metropolitan image that the city was thought to have, because it didn't have cultural institutions like the Music Center, because the Music Center comes up right around the same time that the museum on the West Side, they opened within 2 years of each other, the museum on Wilshire Boulevard, the Los Angeles County Museum.
LACMA,
yeah. God, it's only been 3 years since I lived in California.
No, you're in Philly now. Yeah. The East Coast will do that to you.
The East Coast will totally do that. But the Music Center, LACMA, Dodger Stadium, these all happened within a few years of each other.
Did Hollywood have anything to do with this? That's what I'm wondering. Like, or did that not count as a cultural institution?
The way Hollywood figures into the Music Center is that you've heard of if you've been to the Music Center, you know, the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion is kind of like the anchor building. And so it's named after Dorothy Chandler. Dorothy Chandler was the woman who essentially did all of the fundraising to build the Music Center. Mm. And what she actually did was, one of the ways in which she was successful was that she drew not only from the, you know, old money elites of Los Angeles, but she also crossed the social boundaries into the, you know, what they would have called in the 50s, the Hollywood Jews. Like she tapped into that new money elite in Hollywood. Yeah, and so the Music Center helped the nouveau riche, the new money elite, the Hollywood folks, gain some social cachet.
Interesting.
As at the same time that the Music Center was also coming to dominate, like was part of many different projects, like the Bunker Hill project that ultimately brought us all the skyscrapers in downtown Los Angeles. It was really all within that same moment that those things happened, and it was essentially. What you see when you look at what is now Bunker Hill, all those corporate skyscrapers and the music center and all those things. And then on the west side, you've got LACMA. What you see there is like I was saying before about power, like that's that landscape is the victory of the business elite in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And the music center was kind of part of
it. It's all so interesting, I think, in this particular moment, especially to think about these points in history when we relied so heavily on artistic pursuits to display some sort of identity. And we can track this all the way back to Louis XIV in Versailles, right? He's doing the exact same thing with his gardens and his fountains. He's relying on artistic
and
pursuits to demonstrate.
Ballets.
Yeah. To demonstrate a sense of who we are. And yet when we hit a crisis, we're so willing to sacrifice that first, right? Before anything mm-hmm. else. And it just, I don't know, raises questions to me about how ingrained that identity really is and how much of it is pretense.
Mm. Yeah, and I guess like when you're, so when you say identity, are you talking about like national identity or like personal identity?
Civic identity.
Level of group identity.
Yeah.
Whether it's civic or national.
Well, I think that's one of the things that we saw play out. You know, obviously, I can't give you the whole history of the Repertory Theater of Lincoln Center, but one of the reasons I think the Repertory Theater failed as a national theater was, first of all, no one could agree on what that meant.
Great.
Part of the issue was, you know, the board of directors was mostly bankers.
Who probably had poor taste in theater.
Yeah. And their idea of a national theater was a theater that showcased classics and, you know, proven works as opposed to being an experimentation ground.
So it was almost like they wanted something that would concretize the history of the arts, but not support working artists.
Yes. Yes. I think that's a much more succinct way of saying what I said in the conclusion of my dissertation.
I told you you didn't have to reread the conclusion.
I think that's exactly what it was. Like Lincoln Center, specifically the Repertory Theater, like rather than being a theater that could incubate and support new American voices, it was more about, like you said, like literally concretizing like a particular idea of what a canon of national works might be. But at the same time, you also had like Kazan and Robert Whitehead, one of the most important Broadway producers in the mid 20th century. But most of the theater critics writing in the weeklies, the more intellectual theater critics were even before anything ever hit the stages at Lincoln Center, they were condemning the selection of Whitehead and Kazan because they were the establishment, right? And I think and also simultaneously, so Lincoln Center, the Repertory Theater opens in 1964. But by 1964, we're already starting to see the rise of the off-Broadway movement and the off-off-Broadway movement and starting to see so many like subsects of like, you know, identity related, you know, theater starting to emerge. And they just ignored all that. And they were thinking much more along the lines of, you know, I read the history as them essentially looking at the Repertory Theater in terms of like what a national theater is, putting things like Death of a Salesman on permanent display, right? And putting, you know, Arthur Miller and Tennessee Williams, who, you know, playwrights I love, but like the idea is like putting playwrights like that, like on permanent display, as opposed to, you know, actually using it to incubate new works.
What an institution like the Public does now.
Right. Yeah.
And
And actually, it's what's interesting is at the very tail end of the Repertory Theater's existence, Joe Papp actually was brought in as the artistic director, but the theater ultimately collapsed for a number of reasons. So Kazan and Whitehead actually got fired after their first season.
Oh, okay.
It's such a juicy story. I wish I had time to tell.
Well,
but they actually,
I think
they
you should write like a screenplay or like a series.
Oh my God, that would be amazing. Yeah. It eventually collapsed, and a big part of it was money. But Joe Papp actually was one of their last, like their last stab and their last shot and like their last
like, he
stab
did it for the Public. Maybe he can save this.
Yeah. But I think the Public, in terms of if you're going to try to establish a national theater model or a theater that's expressive of civic identity. I think the public is much
more. I mean, when students ask if we have a national theater, I'm like, I kind of look towards the public.
And I think also I think one of the reasons the public is able to survive is because they've actually had some really big, I mean, they're probably still raking in money from A Chorus Line, and they're going to be raking in money from Hamilton forever. So they have that money that actually allows them the ability to do more risky works without having to worry about.
Cool.
Turning points.
Well, thanks for doing our homework for us.
Yeah.
Yeah. My pleasure. It's fun to talk about. So I just want to one last thing, all your listeners, like, do not judge me as an historian based on what I said here tonight. I was talking in very broad generalities.
I thought you were going to end with an inappropriate joke.
I think that hopefully everyone knows we're here just having fun and like nerding out, and it's not a professional
forum. It's not a history podcast.
No, I know.
Cool. Yeah. Well, thanks for joining us.
Yay.
Thanks, Dan.
And now joining us as our first guest in our local artist series featuring artists from Yossi and I's current hometowns is Tom Draculich.
So my name's Tom Draculich. I'm currently the professor of ceramics at UNR. I'm taking over for a 1 year sabbatical leave for the area head of ceramics. I got my MFA at UNR, interdisciplinary, but my focus was ceramics. I also got my undergrad at UNR, BA in criminal justice, option. And I'm a process-based figurative abstractionist.
Cool. Those are some big words for your intro.
And it literally just means I smear stuff around.
Awesome. Well, how did you get started in smearing stuff around?
I've always been super interested in abstraction and like weirdly drawn to it, even though I didn't understand it in the least bit. I really didn't understand why I was interested in it or why I was doing it until literally like my midway exhibition for my graduate program. And then it all started to click and I was like, oh, those are the things that are like really compelling about this. And these are the things that draw me to it and keep me doing it. You know, it's not just the idea of making work for the purpose of making work. It's like this idea of like this compulsion for physicality and things like that was really interesting to me and helped kind of develop this idea of process-based figurative abstraction for sure.
Well, when I look at some of the images you have on your Instagram, you have these like clay pots and they look like they're thrown and then they're collapsed in on themselves to some extent. And then with some of your painting, it almost looks like you have these like glossy textured shell around it that almost looks like it's been peeled away. And we see this like rough, raw figure underneath. As you're working in those sorts of abstracting modes, like what are you searching for? What are you looking for or exploring?
So it's all about exploration. Like abstraction is just like 100% exploration. If you start with the idea already at hand, then it's probably not going to be a terribly interesting picture, you know, or sculpture, because you're going to kind of end up with that like Pierre Mondrian, you know, squares. Crazy interesting and super compelling. But you're going to end up with that kind of an idea where it's just like, okay, these are blocks. This is my job. I'm going to talk about this set of language. To me, it was always more compelling to like start with a couple of root ideas and then just kind of expand each image or each object from there. And so like with my ceramic sculptures, what I like to do is I started as a potter. And so I'm still a potter, of course, but sort of with pottery, there are some kind of ingrained ideas, you know, the idea of the figure as a vessel and the vessel as a figure or the vessel as like a human body, you know, the way we describe a vessel is like lip, belly, foot, neck, all those things, which are so like connected to the body that it's really, really interesting. And then of course, like the idea of kintsugi or things like that, where like you're literally repairing something. So in If you have your tea bowl and you break it, you repair it with gold leaf. You glue it back together and it becomes more interesting over time. And you sort of delineate the life of this vessel, of this thing that served. So in graduate school, I started to do this thing where I would make a big pot because I was like, you know, potter's thing to do is just go big, you know, try and make it as big. But making big pots is it only goes so far. And so how to make that like more compelling and how to like introduce the idea of abstraction to that, and taking both of those ideas at hand, you can start breaking them apart and squishing them together and really forcing this physical nature upon them to give them this life in the same way that Kintsugi does.
Is there like a life lesson you walk away from after you make something that abstract like that?
No. Well, so relationships, you know, so it's like, one of my favorite sculptures is like this 5-foot guy that I made. And there's a thing about like the exploration process. Like I know the moves that I want to make and I know the ideas that I want to convey, but I don't always know like where specifically they're coming from. You know, I have my endpoint sort of in mind in terms of like the aesthetic progress, but sometimes you'll really like connect with something. And I had one sculpture in particular that like I built it up and it was like this figure and it had like half an arm, you know, it had these weird body parts. And I realized that it was just me hugging my dog every day. That's when I come home. And so I named it Hug. And because it's that relationship that you start to develop with the way that you're building, as well as the way that you sort of live your life. And so little narratives definitely like become introduced in the objects. Not all the time. That's not like the most thing, but, and so like the idea of finding a metaphor or a meaning in each object that's directly related to me is not like 100% of a reality, but every once in a while I'll get one where I'm like, oh, that is like 100% how I was feeling in that moment, you know, missing my dog, or, you know, I had one where I built it out and just left the inside completely open, you know, and it was like a weird situation where I felt, you know, gutless, like I hadn't or something along those lines, you know. And so those little bits do enter into the work, but they're not like the components that compel the work.
Cool. Do you want the people who see it to walk away with some sort of new experience, like new knowledge of the world or something?
And I'm going to tack on to that, because I was going to say, like, do you care if the audience gets what you're intending, or what is the like purpose of what you're crafting?
Why do you do anything? Yeah.
And what's
ever?
The meaning of life?
So the purpose, yeah. So the purpose is not to like directly convey that, because there's no way in the world you're going to look at this lumpy black pot and be like, oh, that's a dude hugging his dog for sure. You know, like I just recently finished a drawing and it was, based on this guy. I was driving down the street and I seen a guy kicking a wall for no reason. He was high on meth or something. And I was so like weird and interesting that like I made a drawing kind of about it. And there's no way in the world that you're going to like connect the dots between, you know, a guy hugging his dog or like a guy kicking a wall for no reason. You're just going to sort of see these figures and these actions. And unless I literally describe it to you by calling it Hug, or like with that drawing, that's a new series that I'm working on. I'll literally call it, guy kicking the wall for no reason, you know, like those little bits will like help like get the viewer into it, but there's no way that you're going to directly connect to it on a level, which is what's like way more compelling to me personally about abstraction, is the idea that like I'll have my connections, but I'm presenting the viewer with something that's kind of unique. So I like to draw this, like, I like to live on this edge where everything is like familiar, but like fully unique. So it's like, you kind of feel like it's a figure. You kind of feel like it might not be a figure. And so you have your own personal experience with it, which is what's like, it's like a Rothko thing. You know, he's got this idea of these, you know, floating squares being these like entities that are doing all these things that are super interesting. But at the end of the day, they're squares. And unless like the viewer can really bring themselves to it and really experience it in that way, it's a little bit lost. They become floating squares. And so that's kind of where I was coming from, is like bringing this like heavy figurative action into it, where it's like, if the viewer just sees it and they don't pay attention to the way that I'm making marks or I'm dealing with structures, at least they can see it in some way as a figure and they can sort of deal with it on their own level. And so that's where that dynamic really becomes super interesting to me.
Cool.
So I don't want to tell the viewer anything.
You don't, you want to like keep a secret.
I don't want to keep it secret. I want to leave it up for their experience. And it's not even like a fully interpretation kind of a thing. It's mostly just that experience. If you have that situation, you know, where you're driving down the road and you see some dude kicking a wall for no reason, like that's my experience. Like I'm gonna take that in and be like, okay, well, you know, what's going on with this? Where is this coming from? You know, I'm gonna navigate that on my terms through my personal sort of experience. And that's where you develop that like real interesting personal connection.
What is a compliment or a response to your art that would be particularly meaningful to you? Like, how would you want someone to respond to it, to your face?
Just that they had to pay attention to it. You know, that just that you had to spend more than 4 seconds with it.
Yeah.
In general, you know, and not just to get it or understand it or anything like that, but just so that, you know, they spent more than 4 seconds looking at it is like really, really rad to me. I think that's like goal is just to have someone spend more than 4 seconds looking at a thing, because that activates everything that you think and perceive and deal with the world.
Yeah, you're sort of disrupting their habits and their normal way of going about the world. And when they stop and want to spend time with something, there's some amount of pleasure, no matter what the actual response is. And then there's also a lot, I think, that does have the ability to give you new thoughts and then make you go on to the next thing with a new perspective that you're sort of carrying with you.
Yeah, and what that's I was thinking, like you were saying, how a part of your process is about exploring, right? It's not like I'm going to paint these squares or I have this idea in mind. It's about exploring through physicality, through your experience, your own perspective, and bringing that to the work. And in some ways, your like ideal response asks the viewer to also explore. So it's not like, oh, I look at that and that's a man hugging a dog. Like, oh, what am I seeing here? And it forces me to pick up on clues or sort of view the details in a way that I might not otherwise.
Yeah.
Cool.
Exactly.
So you were the 2019 inaugural city artist for Reno, Nevada. What does that mean?
So it's like, so there was some crazy complications in the way that the city was able to develop exhibitions during 2018. And so they developed this idea, which is fairly unique. I think they had one in Portland, and a couple other weird little cities were doing the city artist idea. But essentially, it's like being the poet laureate.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, because I know that there are poet laureates for towns and states and, you know, the U.S. And so it's that same idea.
Yeah, so it's pretty much identical. So it's like being a representative of what our art community is and can be for that year. And so I did a full solo exhibition at City Hall, and then I did a curated exhibition of some of my mentors, Richard Jackson and Fred Reed, which was way, way better than my
show. Oh, I'm sure that's not true. But cool, we'll check them out.
Well, you're from
mentors. It's got to be.
Okay, that's right.
you're from Reno, right? You sort of grew up there?
Yeah, I've never been anywhere else.
Cool.
Never been anywhere else?
Okay. Well, I've been other places, but I've only lived here.
Yeah. How would you say that growing up in Reno shaped you as an artist, or how you sort of perceive the world?
Sense of place is pretty important to the way that I navigate line, and also physicality, right? So we live in this weird place that's like really, really tough and really durable, but also incredibly fragile. And so if you drive your car up Peavine on an off-road, right? You're going to tear up the sagebrush. You're going to tear up all these small weeds, and that mark of your action will exist forever. If you walk the same path for 2 days or 3 days, you're going to leave your physical mark. And so these marks are definitely like ingrained. Like if you look at the way that I'm dealing with the structures of like the way that I'm dealing with like the painting behind me, you know, it's all ingrained in that idea of how that physical action can like sort of respond in the land. And so looking at the land and the way that it is, and all these little marks and all these little details, you know, the other big thing that everybody says when they come into the desert is like, oh, the desert's really interesting because you have to like pay attention to the little tiny flower. You know, it's not like something where there's just trees and green, you know, you have to sort of find it. You have to find the things that are super interesting and super, super beautiful. And so like those definitely like totally are ingrained in the way that I consider, you know, abstraction and just art in general. Color palette, no.
You're not stuck in that 90s Southwest desert.
Yeah.
So I grew up in Tucson. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I know what like growing up in the desert's like. And I feel like the color palette is that like tan and turquoise and like with light purple. So not that.
Yeah, I'll go for medium cadmium yellow with my oil paint, but I won't ever put brown in it. Or I'll go like full homogeny and stick with just white tearing through it or black.
Cool. Did you feel any responsibility to represent Reno as the city artist?
Absolutely. You know, so I chose Richard Jackson and Fred Reed, not just because they're my mentors, but because they have had such an incredible impact on the ceramics community, the art community in general. I mean, Fred Reed taught at UNR for, he's going to be mad if you ever saw this because I have no idea how long he taught for, but like 30 years, retired as the lab tech. But he also took classes from everybody, you know, Craig Shepard, everybody. And so he was just ingrained in that. So he's totally like this lineage that has like developed forever that is incredibly important to me to be able to perpetuate. And then Richard Jackson is, of course, his understudy. And I'm, of course, you know, sort of Richard Jackson's understudy. And so it's this like lineage of people that like want to take care of our art community and want to propel everybody that's doing all these cool things. Because the Reno art community is really, really crazy diverse. You know, we tend to like to focus on like the Burning Man stuff, but we don't know that there are, you know, people like Linda and Walter, Linda Uroff and Walter McNamara out there, you know, Kelsey Harder is out there. Jim McCormick has been doing some of the most insane stuff, had been doing the most insane stuff forever. Cool. You know, there are some super incredible artists. And the cool thing about Reno is that like cost of living used to be pretty low, you know, it's getting kind of crazy now, but it was a place where people could just work. Like you could just do your art the way you wanted to outside of the market and outside of the art world and, you know, survive for the most part, you know, doing pots or having a part-time job. So it's always been a really, really amazing place. So it's like a lot of pressure to be like, oh yeah, I gotta represent pretty hard.
Cool. And what, this is sort of my last thought about art in the city. But what role does art have in a city? Like what can it do? What are the possibilities?
The possibilities are bringing art to an unassuming public, right? I think, you know, having a show in City Hall, people go to City Hall and they don't know like what they're in for. And then they see like a really cool, interesting show. And it's like, okay, cool. There's these people out here doing this really, really interesting stuff. So I think that's really like the big thing about bringing art directly into the city is that you just create this awareness for an unassuming public that otherwise I wouldn't do it. You know, if you go to the museum, like it's a hassle, you know, it's like, okay, we got to plan a day to go to the museum. We got to pay our $7 a person. But if you have all this free stuff out there, people are just so like connected to it. You know, you don't know. And then all of a sudden, maybe you'll stop in your tracks and be like, oh, that's a really great picture. I'm going to go look at that. So it's incredibly important, way more so than like a museum or a gallery. A gallery is even worse because when you see the gallery word, for most people, it's terrifying. It's like, okay, I got to go to this place where I got to know stuff. I got to know, you know, who these artists are or whatever. Like I can't just go in there and just experience it. Whereas if you go to City Hall or any of the other small galleries that the city runs and you just see artists doing art, it's like, okay, you can directly connect to it. And 9 times out of 10, that art will be as significant and worth viewership as anything in the museum or anything in any gallery.
Very cool.
That's such a great thought that having this city artist and bringing art into what we think of as the public and common good, there's a way in which it's removing that elitist element from it and making it a lot more accessible to a lot more people. And I mean, this is so important because art, it is a place of exploration, right? It is a place where we push our boundaries and we push ourselves to think differently and to understand the world around us. And if we're not engaging in, I think, that kind of creative problem solving, there's so much I don't know. It's all meaningless.
Yeah, for sure. I think, you hit the nail on the head a bit, because like the whole point of it is creative problem solving, especially with abstraction, or especially with some of the crazy things, like even like Kiki Smith, like it's not abstraction, but they're like these crazy things connected together that it's like, if you don't have creative problem solving, you're not going to be able to navigate the realities of our world from here on. You're just going to sort of do your thing and walk through the world aimlessly. You have to learn how to creatively problem solve, and putting art in front of people does that in a beautiful way because it's art.
And how do you teach that to your students?
Pretty much. I definitely like one thing that I like to focus with, because ceramics is such a problem-based project. Everything is like a new problem. There are all these wacky rules. Everybody shows up thinking that they can just kind of like mush a bunch of clay together.
Oh, that's not how it works. I'm just kidding.
No, God, no.
It's not just mushing it together.
Yeah, it's a big process, And so it's like just perpetual problem solving, perpetual thought. Which is just incredible to me. And so I always try and talk to students and say, think about the things that like it took to build this, and think about the logic that you had to undergo to learn how to get to this point, and then sort of try to apply that in the future. If you see something, anything in general, just, start to develop that kind of problem solving language. And then, above and beyond just the practical means, when you're paying attention to arts, focus, like give it its give it respect, give it that time that it needs, pay honest attention to the things around you, because you'll learn so much. It's like sort of like the way that I'm making these weird connections between the, Nevada landscape and the way that I deal with line quality. Mm. Not paying attention to the fact that you're connecting to that, then you're never going to understand it, and then you'll be lost in it.
I was wondering if you could sort of take us through your process from how you conceive of a project and maybe what kinds of changes it undergoes throughout the process and how you decide it's a finished thing.
So how I decide it's a finished thing is kind of complicated. It's not one thing that I absolutely despise in abstraction is when an artist says it's done when I say it's done. You should absolutely have some guides and some understanding of what like your outcome should be. But you should always play throughout the whole sort of gamut, and so that's sort of tricky. So like I said, I'm onto a new set of drawings that I've been doing, and the whole basis of it. So, oh my gosh, it's going to be a long conversation. That's kind of how everything with abstraction is, because I developed these like sets of rules, and then like you always want to sort of break them and sort of move them as much as possible while you're working. But you always have like a set of outcomes that you actually want, And so the new set of drawings, I'm dealing with like symbolic language, like hearts and swastikas and dollar signs and things like that, as a homogenous sort of component. So just like with my white paintings and my black sculptures, I'm interested in this idea of like just sort of compounding things into homogeny and then sort of breaking it apart. And so the two rules that I always make is that number one, I need to have an advancing layer that feels either like a path or like a trail, or it feels like some sort of water formation. Mm. And then below that, I need to have some level of atmosphere. And then also above that, I need to have some level of like actual figurative action happening. So I have these three rules that I need to abide by. And in between all that, I can work like completely freely until I find those moments where, yes, I'm really like connecting with each sort of element that I've set up for myself. So it's like it's kind of specific, but generally I'll start with like a root idea, like, okay, so hearts, it's an abstraction, right? It's super well understood abstraction. What happens if I just draw a heart over and over and over and over and over and over again, like a psychopath, right? And then what happens to homogeny? Like once you draw a heart 1,000 times in the same section, it becomes just a mess, right? Mm. How do you sort of develop that into like an actual visual language that connects to a greater sort of narrative?
Yeah, it feels like those three rules that you're almost like world building. You're building like mini worlds in your art.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, cool. Very cool. Mm-hmm.
abstraction is.
It's also so lovely because I think a lot of times when people see abstraction, they think that the artist is just like waving their arms around and like hoping something lands on the canvas or whatever. And that's I don't think that's ever how it actually happens. There's always a set of rules and there's always a set of...
Absolutely. So that's the second thing that I despise. And I was just talking to a colleague about this because he's an abstractionist as well. And that's like our like no is whenever someone's doing abstraction and they say, I'm just expressing myself. It shouldn't be how it works. I mean, it's a good start. It's a good way to like introduce yourself to what you're doing. I'm sure it's the way that I sort of dealt with getting into abstraction. But at some point, you need those rules. You need to have a structure.
Yeah.
You need to know what you're about and what you're interested in, or you're just...
And that's what makes people want to look at it, because we are always trying to figure out what's going on.
Yeah.
And if we can't start to discern some degree of language that's happening in these artworks, then we move on.
Exactly.
We're just like, that's a hot mess. I don't care.
Exactly. But
if we can see these layers and especially when you look at like a set of your paintings or something, for example, there's commonalities, and so you can start to see what the rules are that you're playing
with.
And then you see why each one is interesting, because it's putting these rules in a different arrangement.
And exploring them each time that you make a new, you know, work.
Yeah.
So I think it's about time for provocation. Are you ready to issue our... What is your provocation for us today?
So my provocation is super simple. Okay, so I had talked about the idea that I didn't actually understand what I was doing or why I was so compelled by abstraction, why I'm so stuck doing it until like my midway during graduate school. And the thing that really connected to me and really helped to build that was Tamara Schrantz, Professor Schrantz, was the chair of my committee. And she would perpetually talk about this idea of our brains actually shift when we see something that's abstract. When we see something that's representational, we start to look at it like, okay, so if that's a pigeon sitting on a fence pole, we're going to look at that work of art and we're going to judge it accordingly. Like, what are the proportions? What's the scale? How are these things working? You know, is there positive, negative space? What are the volumes and things like that? Now, it shifts when you're dealing with abstraction, and it becomes, in my opinion, a little bit more interesting, because then it becomes this idea of, okay, so it's something that I don't know, so how in the world could I actually critique it? And your brain's going to shift, and you're going to start focusing on things like tonality, color quality, line quality. You know, what are the marks about? Are they aggressive? Are they serene? You know, those little things start to become super, super important. And they also sort of describe that physicality of the process. And so my provocation would be to go find some sort of an abstraction and then critique it. Now, that's not super easy. Mm. And we all are sort of ingrained with how to critique work. It's really second nature. It's how we deal with the world. And the way that I teach critique is a four-step process. Super, super simple, super typical. You can Google how to critique art and you'll find the same thing. You describe, you analyze, you interpret, and then you judge. And so, of course, with abstraction, it's a little bit more difficult to come to the fourth conclusion without a little bit of secondary information. But go out and find an abstraction, describe it in your head, analyze it in your head, interpret it in your head, and then judge whether it was successful or not. And so if you see something, you know, simply describe it, right? If it's white, it's white. What are the marks, right?
Okay.
Talk about difference in positive and negative space. Then analyze those things. You know, what is the line quality? What is the color quality? Is it super vibrant? Is it really pastel? You know, what are these sort of elements? And then look at like the line quality, of course, is super important to me. So are they aggressive marks? Were they really physical marks? Is there some level of gravity? You know, think about like Jackson Pollock and Linda Banglis. You know, did they just pour something on it and then move that around? Not like those Instagram things that they're doing.
Yes.
Pour one and then another one.
Very different thing.
That's not cute. Yeah, thank you for not knowing. I only learned someone was talking about pour paintings, and I was like, Jackson Pollock? And they were like, no. And I was like,
oh, no.
It's kind of like those spinners that you used to get in like
at the fair
when you were like eight and you pour the paint and it spins.
Like a Damien Hirst painting. Like there's a very famous artist who did that as a practice, and he's super wonderful.
Oh, all artist. I know about his work is the shark.
Yeah, that's a wonderful. Yeah. He also did a series of spin paintings.
Cool. Okay.
Step is to judge it, like judge what effect it has on you. You know, how do you navigate it? You know, like think about the first three steps, and then, you know, think about how that affects you. And then maybe if you have some outside information, like an artist statement, or you can find the resume or something, you know, judge it, figure out where it lands.
All right. So we're going to be confronting abstraction.
That's lovely. This week. Oh, I think Yassi froze. But thank you so much for being a part of this. It was wonderful talking to you.
And great.
Thank you.
We'll splice in whatever she said.
Yeah. What sorry. Here.
The face. That's pretty adorable. yeah, this has been super fun. Thank you so much for letting me do it. Cool.
All right. Awesome. Thank you so much, Tom, for joining us.
And thanks everyone for listening. If you want to know more about any of the cool stuff that we talked about in this week's episode, be sure to check out our show notes.
And do the provocation. I guarantee you, wherever you live, your city has some large piece of abstract public art you can look at.
That you've probably been questioning your whole life.
Yeah, you're like, what is that? Well, here's how you're going to figure out what it means to you and your civic identity. Take these four steps, describe, analyze, interpret, and judge it. And let us know what you come up with.
Share it with us on all of our social media platforms. Art If Podcast on Facebook, Instagram, and sometimes Twitter.
Never Twitter. But if you're tagging us, I'll go back. I'll check it. I forget about Twitter. In our next episode, so not next week, but the week after, our gallery topic will be art and journey, and not the band Journey, other things. And then we talk with conductor Nolan Dresden.
Music conductor or train conductor?
Yes, you read the interview. He's not a train conductor, but maybe we can interview a train conductor. That would be kind of fun.
That seems like an art form.
Yeah. I'll make choo-choo sounds.
Be sure to review us wherever you're listening.
Tell your friends.
All right. Bye, everybody.
This is the last time we filmed this so late at night. Or tape it. Bye. Yeah.
Art If Podcast is produced by
Hattie Cry
and Yassi Jahanmir.
Our theme music was composed by Muhammad Abdul Salam.
Follow us at Art If Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook to stay up to date on upcoming episodes and to join our vibrant community of artists.